listening to Castrol CarCast on Podcast One.
Well, what a show for you today. The great Mario Andretti, an in-depth interview with Mario Andretti live at the World of Speed. Man, still has his fastball. I think you will be very impressed with the stories he tells when we get into all of it. First Continental OE Technology Series. You find weird things in your car. Sometimes people even find bizarre things in their car. People find snakes in their car. Now, you want to find some belts? You find Continental belts. Bet you didn't know they're OE on millions of Chrysler, Dodge, Ford, BMW, VW, GM vehicles. Continental is launching the aftermarket multi-V belt with the OE pedigree. It's their OE technology series, fanatically engineered for perfect fit, form and function, fit, form, and function for 98% of vehicles on the road in the U.S. and in Canada. Continental OE technology series, multi-V belt, the belt with the OE pedigree, and get the full story at oetechnologyseries.com. That's oetechnologyseries.com. And now let's talk to the great Mario Andretti.
Thank you guys for coming out here and spending your evening with us. We do a podcast called CarCast, and some of you may be familiar with it. That's Matt, the moderator, DeAndrea.
Hello.
Over there. We travel around, and we share the good news. We do have good news for you guys tonight, because Mario Andretti is with us, and he's backstage, and he's going to start his way to the stage. So
big hand.
Put your hands together.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mar, why don't you have a seat over here? We'll see if his mic's heated up. Mario, thank you for joining us. We're all, of course, huge fans. I think, you know, everyone's a fan of Mario Andretti. Everyone sort of grew up with Mario Andretti. But I think when you walk through the halls here and you see all the different vehicles he raced, especially in a time where people sort of pick a sport, you know, you either play baseball or you play football or you play basketball, and every once in a while there's a Bo Jackson that comes along and plays two sports, or a Deion Sanders who plays two sports. But when you see all the sports Mario Andretti did, and it's that much more impressive when you pass the Pikes Peak car out there, when you pass the NASCAR, when you pass the GT40. Are you thankful that you came up in an era where you could drive everything?
Oh, absolutely. Are you kidding? Feel blessed, actually, because my ambition was obviously to try to experience the different disciplines, because, as you know, our sport at the top level, you have disciplines that you can just potentially specialize in and be very happy. You know, like just to give you an example, like Richard Petty, you know, on a stock car, he never was in a sports car, never was in something else, and so on and so forth. But I felt that my specialty was open wheel, single seaters, and, you know, which is pretty widespread because of the dirt tracks. That's where I started in, you know, the midget sprint cars. And then, of course, the champ cars, the Indianapolis cars, and then Formula One. But there's also sports prototypes, long-distance racing, you know, that I thought that was very fascinating. And And I, you know, I'd love to be able to have the opportunity to drive for the top teams like Ferrari, Porsche, you know, along the way, and, you know, Le Mans, Daytona, 24 Hours, Sebring, and on, you know, and many of the others. So anyway, like, I got so much satisfaction out of being able to do that, and not just do it, but be able to win, you know, in different disciplines where it's not necessarily your specialty.
In the different types of racing that you've done over the years, by the way, 111 career wins. Pretty amazing.
Thank you.
What was it about the different forms of racing that appealed to you most? Was it the spectacle of F1, or was it just the challenge of the car, open wheel? And what makes you, like, and then you go and you do Le Mans. Is it because you just want to run Le Mans, or just because you want to run a particular type of car?
Yeah, I mean, from a driver's standpoint, the challenge is to be able to master that particular type of car, because, as you say, it's a little bit outside of your specialty, if you will. But, and each car is like an animal, you know, like a wild animal. They're all different, you know, and as an animal tamer, you know, like you say, you got to try to make each one of these animals purr, otherwise they're going to kill you, you know. So a race car is almost the same thing, you know, to try to understand the nuances and then what the car really wants, what it responds to. Some are quicker, you know, like a laser as far as the be able to react and move around. Others are lazier and easily overdriven, so you got to be able to slow down to go fast. But all of these things, however, teach you and bring you another dimension as far as knowledge of the dynamics of cars, period. And I thought that being able to venture to other disciplines, it really helped me understand more what's going on, you know, in our world, and benefit ultimately, because I could adapt, you know, to even you know what I love, the Indy cars or Formula One. Sometimes adapt if the cars were not the way that I really wanted to be, but I was able to find a way, you know, to drive, so I could overcome some of that, you know, the fact that we're on maybe not as balanced as they were. So all that I felt, you know, career-wise, it benefited me. But benefit is one thing, and the passion and the love for driving something else. And fundamentally, I just love driving a race car, period.
Yeah. Adam, it was like you were saying, it's difficult for any one professional athlete to have the range that someone like Mario Andretti does. This isn't about becoming the best IndyCar driver. It's about becoming the best driver. And, like, who, like, you can't do it if you're a golfer or a tennis player. You can't be the best ball player.
Right.
You know, and hit every type
of
ball.
Or and also, it's an era that we'll never see that era again. It's like in football when guys played offense and defense, you know. I don't think anyone can sort of challenge you for greatest driver of all time anymore, because no one's going to be able to drive in that many different varied events. And one of them, the one that, I don't know why, but it struck me the most was Pikes Peak. And, you know, Pikes Peak is dangerous and scary, and doing it in that champ car out there without a roll cage seems more dangerous and more scary. And being the first man to do it in under 12 minutes, I believe. Can you tell us the story of Pikes Peak and Mario Andretti?
Well, that's quite the story, because, you know, I was always traveling around, very friendly with the Unsers, and Bobby especially, and he just finally talked me into running Pikes Peak, because that was their thing. I mean, that was their playground. They obviously, you could not beat an Unser at Pikes Peak, period. They knew it so well, and the thing that's really weird about that particular event is the fact that unless you spend weeks of time there just going up and down, and really figure out, it's got, I don't know how many hundreds of turns and so on and so forth in the 12 miles all the way up. And I didn't have the time to do that. So, but when you, during practice, you practice one third, then the next day one third, the other third, and then the top. Mm-hmm. And that's the way, because they had different classes. They had stock cars, they had, the, you know, and the Indy car. I mean, yeah, then the champ cars. So the different categories, so they couldn't, you know, because...
Go all the way up.
Go all the way up. So anyway, and when you qualify, it was only from starting line to Glencoe, which is midway. So the only time you did it full was race day. And so even though you have it in your head... And even the night before, you go, okay, God, we're up there, we're on the tree line, and that's and so on and so forth. Especially a couple of the areas, like one area they call it the Devil's Playground. It's you're up above the tree line, and it's actually your top speed will be at like 125, 130 miles an hour. It's almost you're at the top. You're probably at about 10,000 feet already. And it's got the straightaway's got a downhill slope. Mm-hmm. And at the end, it's got a right-hander and no guardrail, and you could drop down 2,000 feet. So, I mean, and during practice, I'm said, okay, this is a rock number one, number two, this is where I'm going to back off. And on race day, you know, you have, of course, a lot of people on the sidelines, and you lose your bearings.
Right. And you don't see your markers.
You don't see your markers, and you have no idea how much risk I took, you know, that when I won, because quite honestly, I felt the areas where everybody was going to back off, because you know, if you go over the side, a bird will, this used to say, the bird will build a nest up your butt before you reach the bottom, you know. And they were right, you know. But so these are the areas where I really took a lot of risk, you know, going deeper and just really pitching sideways, and I made it. And you know, this was the third time that I raced there. And so when I won it, I figured I'm never coming back, because I said there's no way. When I got to the top, I said, man, I need a shot, you know, whiskey here.
At that point, the answers were probably like, thanks, buddy, you're
out.
Calm
me down.
You're done. You know? It's our mountain. You're done.
It was one of those, you know, it was way a lot of risk. But, you know, a lot of satisfaction goes with it, because you know that you got away with it, you know. You dodged a few bullets.
We were talking backstage about... we had talked some years ago, I think, when the movie Rush came out with the Ron Howard, Brian Grazer, the Hunt, and Niki Lauda film. And Mario was telling me that he was a little miffed that when they were looking at the leaderboard and Hunt got third place, or did he get fifth place, or do we know, they sort of cropped Mario out, who won the race at the top. And I literally saw Brian Grazer yesterday, and I told him, Mario's pissed.
And we're going to see him tomorrow, and we're going to tell him.
And he did laugh, but we were, you know, if you watched a movie, it's a really good movie, but obviously the focus of the movie is Hunt, who came in third place. But Mario won that race in that downpour in, I'm not sure, what part of Japan was that in, sorry?
Mount Fuji. It was
Mount Fuji. And that's an incredible race, yeah. And... for those of you who saw the film, I think it'd be nice to sort of walk us through that day and that deluge in winning that race.
Well, again, you know, it was the start of the race was coming up, and I mean, and the skies just opened. I mean, a deluge, and as drivers, we were trying to see if they could get the organizers to delay the race by maybe 30 minutes. And they said, because of TV, they said, no, we got to go. And circumstances were really dire, I'm telling you. And you know, in Formula One, you don't just, you know, do pace laps or anything else. You know, you just go, you start standing start, and you go. And in those days, you didn't even do one lap like they do now, then stop and go. You had to just go. You got in the car, and that was a start. And quite honestly, I mean, the aquaplaning was unbelievable. Down the straightaway, especially. The straightaway was the worst part. I mean, it would just pop, pop, pop. You know, you can keep the car straight. And, you know, a lot of guys went off and so forth. And, you know, I was lucky. I was able to just keep it on the track. And everything went well, you know. And James also obviously kept it on there. And he couldn't catch me, you know, because the track was drying. And, of course, with that, rain tires, you know, the rain tires start coming apart, you know, because of their soft rubber and everything else. So it was a kind of a strategy thing. And I was wondering, you know, as a leader, what the hell are you going to do? You know, do I stop for dry tires at the end, you know, for the last five, six laps? Because with dry tires, all of a sudden you pick up 10, 12 minutes a lap. I mean, seconds a lap. So anyway, I know that Hunt went in the pits for toward the end of the race for slicks, and he was catching, but I mean, I was far enough ahead of him, and I was hunting for wet spots toward the end of the race everywhere, you know, so I could stay in the wet and keep the tires together, and I still beat him by more than a lap.
Did yeah, but if you saw the movie, you couldn't tell.
Yeah,
it seemed like James Hunt may have won that race.
I guarantee you, I did it, though.
Yeah.
I told you you'd be loving Mario Andretti. The guy's a saint. Now, Tommy John. Oh, man, it's hot out there. A lot of people working up a lather downstairs. I always wear Tommy John, the best. You'll never go back. You will never go back to what you were wearing before you started wearing Tommy John. That much I promise you. Legs never ride up. Waistbands never roll down. Horizontal, quick draw fly, saves men tons of time fumbling down there. Feather light air fabric guarantees zero visibility on the panty lines for the ladies, so that's a plus. All backed by the best pair you'll ever wear, or it's free guarantee. It's the best. You will never return to your old underpants once you've set sail for Tommy John. Tommy John, no adjustment needed. Right, Max Pata?
Hurry to TommyJohn.com/carcast now to get 20% off your first order. That's TommyJohn.com/carcast for 20% off. TommyJohn.com/carcast.
When, a question I've never had, but were there always radios in cars when you were racing? And if not, when did those start? Because I know they've been around for a while, but also I'm not sure if you had them in the early days.
Well, we had radios when actually when you come in a pit and so on and so forth, so you could communicate with the engineer, but they did not allow the radios. You could have had them, but they did not allow radios, you know, in communication while you were
when you were driving.
Driving,
so there's no spotters.
So
or
at that point,
there
was no communication. It was all, you know, by board, the signal board, you know. So and you'd be surprised how well you could still communicate with that, except you could only do it once a lap, you know, when
right.
you saw the board. But it was like that for everybody else, you know. So, but again, you know, it was just later on they felt, for even for safety reasons, that they would allow to have radio communications, you know, while you were driving.
Do you, I made a documentary about Paul Newman, and Mario was nice enough to contribute to it. And, of course, Newman Haas back in the day in Indy, and your son as well. Do you have thoughts, memories of Paul in those days?
Oh, gosh. Wonderful memories. Paul was really an incredibly, outstanding individual in every way, honestly. The best part about the man was that he really, truly loved our sport. He was not just a figurehead, a celebrity. He was all in. And as you know, he did driving himself, you know. So, but he was a great supporter, and as a team owner, I'm telling you what, I just love driving for the man. I drove for him for 12 seasons, you know, and I'm the one that brought Carl Haas and Paul together as partners, and they hated each other, you know, because he was Paul, when he was in the Can-Am series, he was racing Lolas, and Carl Haas was the importer of Lolas, and he was accusing Carl that he was selling Paul cars overweight, you know, so. And so that was that sort of thing. But I brought them together, and it was turned out to be a marriage made in heaven because, you know, the success that they had with the team, not only myself, but with my son, you know, Michael, and also with, you know, with the Bardet, you know, Sebastian Bardet, and others, D'Amato. So anyway, it was, but Paul, you know, was a great guy. He was a real prankster too, you know, and you would never think, you know, that he would be that, but he was, and I enjoy that side of it, you know. And he always great for bets, you know. We'd bet, you know, on anything, you know, like football or whatever. Seemed like, you know, he always lost, and we bet like $1.79, you know, and. Yeah. And then so then he sent me a check. He'd FedEx next day a check, and it cost him like $18 to FedEx it, and it was a check for $1.79, you know, that type of thing. It was he was just a neat guy, you know. It was just so fun to be around.
The one of the other cars that's out front there is a GT40 Ford, obviously. I think it's a Mark IV, and that's the one you won overall at Sebring in 67, I think, or 68. I can't...
67.
67. You have some recollections of that win?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a win is obviously, is always sweet, as you can imagine. In fact, it was only a couple of weeks after I won Daytona, the 500. You know, so it was, you know... it was great to have that kind of, you know, the success, you know, in a short period of time. And then my co-driver was Bruce McLaren, a good friend, a great guy. He taught me a lot about road racing in those days. And again, this, as you know, there's a movie about Ford
v. Ferrari. Coming out.
And this was the period where Ford... just wanted at all costs win Le Mans. And I mean, and they pulled nothing. I mean, that was amazing, the effort they had behind it. And because of that, I did so much testing. And I volunteered to be part of all the tests because I wanted to hone my skills in road racing because of Formula One. And because of that, I was part of the development from the J car, the Mark II. And then the J car, and then this was the ultimate GT40, which was a Mark IV, and I was involved in high speed testing because they didn't have time to do wind tunnel testing in Kingman, Arizona. You know, we were running speeds in the 230 mile an hour range, you know, on a 5 mile track, and comparing to the other cars. So I was very familiar with this car. And it was, you know, it was definitely a worthy winner.
Well, speaking of that movie, I think Christian Bale's going to be playing Ken Miles.
Yeah,
coming
Matt
up.
Damon's playing Caro Sebi.
We spent a little time at Laguna Seca 2 weeks ago with Ken Miles' son, his mechanic, and working.
Peter.
With Peter Miles with Chip...
Connor.
Chip Connor, yes. Got a couple of nice cars. do you have recollections of Ken Miles?
I do, actually. I joined the team the season after they had begun, and he was there at the very beginning. And he was the senior test driver, and I was basically the junior. And but then, you know, obviously I came, you know, a long way after that, but because I was part of all of it. But And then he was killed at Riverside, you know, during the test we were at together with the J car. And so I didn't get to spend much time with him because I used to really pick these guys' brains all the time because, you know, these guys were so experienced and road racers. And I really, I was in a learning stage, you know, that I wanted to, again, to hone my skills because my objective was to try to get into Formula One as soon as I could. I'll tell you why. It was in 65 when I was a rookie at Indianapolis. I finished third, and Jim Clark won in the Lotus. At the banquet after the race, Monday, they were saying our goodbyes. I said to Colin Chapman, I said, Colin, someday I'd like to do Formula One. And he said, Mario, when you think you're ready, you call me and I will have a car for you. I mean, can you imagine, I mean, as a kid, hearing that from sure. Colin Chapman. So, and I went to work, you know, to try, because at that time in IndyCars, you know, they didn't have many road races. In fact, in 65, they only had one road race, and I won it. And that was the only race that I won that season, but I won the championship because I was running, you know, second and thirds and so forth. But the bottom line is this, I lobby like crazy to get more and more road racing, you know, and IndyCars because of that. But 3 years later, in 68, I called, I told Colin, I said, I'd like to do the last race of the season. And he, actually, I said, I'd like to do the last two races of the season, which included Monza. And I went, and he said, right, I'll have a car. And then we went to Monza. I tested, I felt, immediately, I felt really, really part of that car, the Formula One, because of, it's so nimble, light, and so, you know, just reactive, you know. And so we did well in the first test. You know, actually, I was quicker than Chris Amon had set a time about a week before in a Ferrari. So, but Monza, it's a long story. I don't know if I want to take that much time. But the Monza... I had to come back on a Saturday to race at the Hoosier 100 in Indianapolis with one of those dirt cars, like, you know, the right. one, and because I was up for the championship. And so I qualified on a Friday and got on a, you know, a plane, obviously, back here, and I finished second to Foyt at the Hoosier 100 on the dirt. Went back Sunday morning, and I was in violation of the 24-hour rule but an hour and 20 minutes when I got there, and they before the start of the race, and they didn't let me start.
Was the rule that you needed to be there or sleep there?
No, the rule was that you could not compete in another FIA event, which is, you know, even the IndyCar, even the all the championship races in IndyCar were FIA events within 24 hours. But I knew that that was going to be the problem, and the organizers, Bacci Galuppi and Count Lurani, they agreed that they were going to waive the rule because I said, you know, what's the point, me even trying it? And then, but when I arrived there, there was a protest, and Colin Chapman, actually Ferrari protested, and Colin Chapman couldn't speak a word of Italian. They wouldn't let me in the room, you know, to defend myself, and so they did not let me start. So the following race was at Watkins Glen, and I never seen one. And I put the car on pole, you know, with Jackie Stewart second. So, and that was my very first experience, you know, in Formula One. So I was pretty well prepared for it. And a lot of it, I give credit to, you know, the Ford program, you know, really to prepare me as much as possible for that sort of thing.
Castrol Edge, stronger under pressure. Engines can lose up to 10% of performance due to friction. Castrol Edge, fluid titanium, works better under pressure. Three times stronger than leading full synthetic against viscosity breakdown. It's the best. They did a test with 5W30 viscosity grades, full synthetic, and they were three times better. Edge, it's formulated in ways to exceed the toughest industry standards. It is Castrol Edge.
You know, you talk about sports car racing and having honing your skills in the road courses. Let's talk about Le Mans for just a second. You won your class in Le Mans, but you did it at an event where it rained 17 of the 24 hours.
Yeah. I mean, I love that place, you know, because you really stretch your legs there. I mean, high speed. I mean, and half of it now is, you know, half of it is public roads, and the other half is, of course, you know, just a regular circuit, you know, a permanent circuit, I should say. There's something about it, you know, that because of the mix of driving, I just love driving that place. And, you know, as you say, in the wet, though, I mean, I'm telling you, at night, in the wet, the speed that you're going, and you're always in traffic because, you know, they have, you know, at least three classes running. And so the closing rate. And I know, and I remember this one particular year, you know, open car, I think it was in 95. I did three stints. Yeah, that's it, right there.
We're looking at it, yeah.
I did three stints in the wet, yeah. and you know, you had to pick the shutoff point at the end of Mulsanne, you know, this 3.2 miles straightaway. You know, I'm looking, there was a church steeple that I was looking, because I couldn't see the shutoff markers because of, you know, the fog in front of you, you know.
This and is then, before the chicane.
This is before the chicane.
Right.
You know? Yeah, and but even after the chicane, still, you know, it's a tough one there, regardless.
Sure.
But before the chicane, and all of a sudden I said, oh, my God, you know, I said, I hope that St. Christopher doesn't leave me. I said, that he keeps that church steeple, you know, nice and clear, you know, because that was my shutoff.
Yeah, light, just you know? A beam of light yeah. on that. That's all yeah. you need, no, just to shine the light there. I also wanted to ask you, we probably a couple of months back, we had Parnelli Jones and his son in the studio telling us some wonderful stories, and they talked a bit about the turbine car and doing some testing with that, and you work with them on that. You drove that for them, right?
I did, yeah, a little.
That actually, car's crazy, by the way.
I envy them because he had so much advantage with that car. Because just clearly, you know, to arrive, the turbine car was not regulated. So Andy Granatelli was really smart to all of a sudden show up with a turbine car. And little did we know that one stint of fuel, for us, it took 80 gallons of fuel. And with a turbine car, they could do it in 35 gallons. So, you know, ultimately, we were fastest, you know, with a standard car. Like, he qualified, I think, seventh or eighth, you know, in the race in 67. And, but the start of the race, I'm on pole, and he's blowing by me on a straightaway, like, there's even a T-shirt out because I flipped him a bird, you know, when he went by.
That was an all-wheel drive
you want that
car,
t-shirt?
Wasn't it?
You want that T-shirt?
Yeah. Was that an all-wheel drive car?
That was, all-wheel drive.
It just seems like a crazy piece of technology in the 60s to have a turbine car that was an all-wheel drive. Had to be one of the few all-wheel Indy cars, or sort of modern all-wheel Indies, right? I don't.
Well, actually, in '69, before you know the big crash, you know, when the wheel came off, I was driving the Lotus four-wheel drive car, which was a derivative of the turbine car of the year before, of '68, where they dominated, and I had the Ferguson system. You know, 70-30, which was fabulous, and we were setting records. You know, every day. You know, we were practicing, and then, but the car started coming apart. You know, breaking. They were, you know, under design, and you know, in '69, 2 days before qualifying, the right rear wheel sheared. You know, the hub sheared, and I had a big crash, fire, and everything else. The car was destroyed to the ground. They had to withdraw all the cars, you know. Then I had to go out there with the standard car. We never, you know, I really planned to race with, because we had two of those four-wheel drive cars, and you know, we still got lucky. You know, in the race we still won it. But
were the four-wheel drive cars faster in the corners?
The corners, yes.
And a little slower in the straights.
Yes,
or
you got
that
it.
How it laid
you
out?
It. You got it. Yeah, yeah. They because obviously you know the drivetrain takes away you know quite a bit of because of the friction. Takes more power to you know to navigate through that. So yeah, definitely straight line was slower, but all the time we were doing was through the corner, you know, through the corner and the short shoot, you know, applying a lot of power. Ultimately, I think it still would have been, if the car could have stayed together, would have been really, really, you know, a big advantage.
If you could just drive one series. We've talked about so many, but if you just had to pick one and somebody said you have to start your career over tomorrow and you just pretty much have to pick a sport.
Oh, now he's going to put me
what,
in that car.
What series would you drive?
Give me two.
All right, I'll give you two.
Indy cars and Formula One.
Oh, yeah.
Indy and
yeah.
Formula One?
All right.
IndyCars, I'll tell you what, something about IndyCar as a top-level series, to me, produces the most complete champion because there's no other series at that level that's as diversified. You know, in NASCAR, they're trying to do a little more and more road racing, but the road race that they do is very simple. Like, you know, even at Watkins Glen, they don't do the long, you know, the loop and all that. And even at Sonoma, they cut a lot of corners out. But in IndyCar, with the street courses, you know, the natural courses, short ovals, super speedways, you know, to be a champion, you have to be able to navigate all of them. And that's, to me, as a driver, it's the ultimate challenge.
Do you think it's as exciting today as it was back then?
Oh,
looking
hell
at
yes.
where yeah. IndyCar is gone? Like, the amount of technology, and now we've got an aero shield that's being developed and a halo that's being developed and all kinds of interesting...
Well, the safety is safety. I mean, it's, at least we keep the drivers around. There's nothing wrong with that. But, you know, but as far as the technology, let's put it this way. The IndyCar series right now is really enjoying some great times because of the depth of talent. Number one is in a driver pool, and plus the teams. You know, there are teams that, you know, as deep as 16, 18 deep, you know, in a pool are capable of winning. And, you know, and there's something to be said. I don't think I remember ever to be this competitive. So the IndyCar series is enjoying some great times right now.
And what do you think of Formula E? That's what I thought.
I'll tell you a little story real quick.
Well, okay.
That by Formula E, my son has a team there, and the organizer, actually the owner of the series, that's Alejandro Agag, says to Michael, he says, you know, a couple of years ago, he says, Michael, I would like to do an interview with your father. And Michael says, I don't think you do.
Mario Andretti, thank you, everybody. Thank you, my friend. Great job. He's still got it. If you're listening at home, you can check out his website, MarioAndretti.com, and shoot him a tweet at Mario Andretti as well.
Well, how about it? Mario Andretti, am I right or am I right? All right, we got a little Q&A coming up in a second. First, betonline.ag. Are you ready for some football? It's officially happening. The week one NFL kickoff. It's upon us. Look for a place to make online wagers. Where should you go? Might I suggest betonline.ag. Take advantage of the best bonuses in the business. Huge matchups. Week one, Green Bay, Chicago, Atlanta, Minnesota, Rams, Carolina, Pittsburgh, New England. We've got a $500 in reward deal for you. Get $500 in rewards, and we'll give it out each week to five listeners and a $5,000 season-long charity contest. Join the conversation on Twitter with hashtag SportsNetChallenge. That's hashtag SportsNetChallenge. I got the Chiefs over the Jags, the Chargers versus the Colts, the Browns over the Titans, and the Rams over the Panthers, and the Seahawks over the Bengals. So check it out. Use the promo code PODCAST1. Get a 50% sign-up bonus today. BetOnline.ag.
We're talking about doing a little Q&A. I felt like we about covered it with Mario Andretti, who, when I was 9 years old, I thought were two people. So I've come a long way in the race world myself. You want to do a couple of Q&A questions, and then we'll wrap this night up and enjoy a cold one. Chris is out
Chris
there
has
with
got
a
microphone for
with
you.
A microphone. If anyone
questions.
Has questions for us.
Did you guys ever fix the head gaskets on the Nissan Turbo car, the one with the fire rings?
No, we had a situation on a, I think it was Newman's 1987 2+2. It was a Trans Am. I mean, it's a Nissan Trans Am car. I hate that there's a Trans Am series in a Trans Am car, and people think I'm talking about Knight Rider. But there was something to do with some O-rings and some head gaskets, and it's a big kettle of expensive fish. And I just got into another car and started racing another car.
Just so, moved to a different car. Also, we mostly blame Leno for that.
We blame Leno, yeah. We brought the car out to Sonoma. We had a little issue with the cam and a timing belt, and it turned out that the race heads, they actually would repair them with basically epoxy clay, yeah. I guess, and then like pour it out the clay, and a chunk of that busted off and got sucked up into a valve or something and clogged, seized up a valve, and it ended up spinning the timing belt on.
Under Leno's watch.
Anyway, it's all Leno, but
yeah,
listen.
It's all Jay.
Look, if anyone builds Nissan race engines, talk to me after the show. But, man, I got to tell you, there's like three guys on the planet who build those turbo motors, and they got you by the short hairs, and they take your engine and
your money.
They don't give it back. They just take your checks. It's tough. Those, you know, the one thing I definitely would say I get jealous about is when we go to the races and we see these guys are running Mustangs with 289s in them, or even a 289 Cobra or big block Cobra, or, you know, a Trans Am car, you know, from 69, 70. You know, you can get the distributor cap from Napa Auto Parts for $9. You know, you could get that engine rebuilt at a lot of different places. If you're dealing with these 80s Nissan turbo cars and those engines break, man, it is a fortune and a lifetime to get those things put back together.
And the Porsche 935 is the same way. Luckily, that's in one piece. But that example, the distributor cap, which, by the way, six cylinder, 12 plugs. It's a $1,500 distributor cap. And God forbid you need a distributor. That's $8,000 if you can find one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nuts. I got to get into karting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Got another question over there. How great was Mario Andretti?
I know.
Such a great ambassador for the sport, right?
I know you just bought the 935 just recently, but is there another historic race car in your crosshairs? You just did your new shop, too, so I know there's a lot of funds going out, but is there anything you have in mind?
There was a car that was just purchased. The 935 he got in 2016, but the newest car, it's only a few months old,
yeah.
is...
There's a 911, a 74 911 sort of done up like a S. It's like an RSR, and Newman actually ran it at Sebring in 77, finished a race, didn't do that well. I think came in like 11th in GT, but it's a 74 big-bodied RSR, and it ran like Sebring, I don't know, 5 or 6 times. It ran the 24 hours at Daytona 5-6 times.
It turned out to be an incredible racing history. It participated in so many races. So we just got that, haven't done much with it yet other than stare at it and flip through the books and do the history on it.
Yeah.
But I don't know, is there a wish list race car?
You're
about to raise the price of it.
There is another Newman 280ZX turbo car, straight six this time, that's kind of out there in a bunch of pieces, and I have some Newman Oldsmobile Cutlass cars, and I have some 300 ZXs, and I have a 280 ZX or so, but this one is different than anything I have. I have some turbo V configuration cars. It's a straight six. It's a cool piece. It's a kind of a bucket, so we'd have to put it back together, but that is a car that I'm trying to get, and I think it would be the 12th Newman car that I have.
The other car that I would like to have seen show up in the collection at some point, we were never able to get it, was toward the end of Newman's career, he raced a C5 Corvette, and I like that car, and it's not a Datsun or a Nissan. So.
Yeah, and I drove a C7 Corvette in a Trans Am race at Willow Springs, and I loved it. So I'm converted.
Everyone's got the to-do list. How about Geico, man? How about you save money on your auto insurance at Geico? Just go to geico.com. 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on your auto insurance. You take that extra money, you put it in your pocket, you save it for a rainy day. That's Geico, geico.com.
Should we do one more question before we call it a night?
Hey, guys. When I was a kid, my dad took me and my brother to a Jaguar dealership to look at a brand new XJ220 right when they first came out.
Yeah,
That was the car that I think made me fall in love with cars. That was just the coolest thing in the world. And so my question to both you guys is there a car you can think of from being a kid or whenever else you saw that made you fall in love with cars? You saw that car and you said, that is the coolest thing in the world, and you've been hooked on cars ever since.
A 95 Ford Lightning.
Mine's a GMC Typhoon.
Yeah, the Typhoon. It's a battle of trucks up here.
I love the steering wheels, man.
The flat dash and the
flat dash.
The fake Allen head screws.
Fake Allen heads, man.
The plastic.
Nothing says speed like fake Allen heads in a dash.
I do like that XJ220. I've been a fan of that for a long time.
That's his favorite. Yeah. And, it is one of our favorite. Cool piece. And for those of you can Google it who don't know what we're talking about, but it was the Jag supercar, mid-engine, had the turbocharged V6 in it. Got a little bit of a rap at the time because it's like, hey, where's the V12? Come on, you're a supercar. What do you got? You got a Ford Ranger engine in this thing, and you're a supercar. But they worked, and I don't know. They're up over 400, getting near 500 grand now, and I think they're gonna keep going. I think it's a cool piece. When I was a little kid, the car that I thought was the coolest shape, because you know when you're 8 years old, you don't really know from overhead valve or V10 or V6 or whatever 0 to 60. I still think that the Dino Ferrari is one of the coolest shaped cars. Now, it's kind of gutless, and it's kind of slow, and it'd be really cool if it was 350 horsepower instead of 186 horsepower, whatever it is.
You can LS swap it.
But if you just... if you just picture a Dino Ferrari to a 9-year-old, and you just kind of picture the way the vents were worked into the doors and everything, That car is one of the best shaped cars.
And it kind of has kind of a like a speed racer cartoon sports car look to it as well.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, it's fantastic. What's
so yours? Oh, wait, are we looking at it? Oh,
so it was the XJ220, but I'll tell you, is early on, I loved the stories as much as just the poster of the car on the wall. And when I saw the movie with Jeff Bridges about Tucker, I fell in love with the Tucker, and I've kind of been a fan ever since because of that movie. So, yeah, I would love to have a Tucker.
No, he wouldn't. He doesn't like Tucker. We're not. You got to pick a sexier car. You picked it.
Well,
you
it's not the sexiest car.
I like Tucker.
No, you picked the Typhoon or the Cyclone. I don't know.
Cyclone, which, whatever. Yuck.
Maybe the.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to say the cars I love. I always give the same answer. I love the BMW M1 Pro car. Not so much the street version,
but the Pro.
The street's a little 80s, but the pro car, if you guys ever see the M1 in full race trim with the BMW M colors going across the hood at an angle and everything, that is just a killer car. Some of those guys have been in some of my races. They have this naturally aspirated, I think it's a 3.5 straight six with just that crazy injection in it, and they tack that thing up to like 8,500, and those...
There you go.
Oh, yeah, those things just scream. That is a cool-looking car in race trim. All right, you guys, put your hands together one more time for Mario Andretti, please. And that's Matt, the Motorator, DeAndrea, over there.
And Adam Carolla, guys.
And until next time, and this is Adam Carolla for Matt the Motorator, DeAndrea saying keep the air in the spare and the bag in the wheel. Thank you, guys.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.